From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. David Sedaris is a pioneer. 26 years ago, the humorist busted through public radio's polite veneer as a begrudging department store elf in the Santaland Diaries.
I'm going to have you fired. I had two people say that to me today. Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired. And I want to lean over and say, I'm going to have you killed.
10 books later, David Sedaris is a best-selling author who draws thousands of fans to his public readings. He writes frequently and candidly about his wisecracking, eccentric family. Calypso, his newest collection of essays, is no exception. When he stopped by on his last sweep through Georgia, I asked him, where would he be without his family?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I always felt so fortunate to have my family. Even when I was a child, I noticed other people, you know, they would eat dinner and then they would go to their rooms or go watch TV or something. And my dad would leave the table the second he finished eating, and the rest of us would sit around for hours and hours and hours every night. Like in high school, you wouldn't have a boyfriend or girlfriend. You wouldn't not be home, because that was the night I made pizzas and we watched scary movies on TV. You wouldn't not go home for Christmas, but you wouldn't get a driver's license and go out with people in a car. You wouldn't do anything that didn't involve your family. I just always felt so fortunate that way.
So I know a lot of people, I grew up in a big family, and you move apart, I think, to differentiate yourself as you did.
Mm-hmm.
When did you fold back in?
Well, you know, I'd left the fold just for a couple of years, and then I moved back to North Carolina. I dropped out of college and I wound up back home, which is really your worst nightmare, right? When you're like 20 years old, your friends are all in college and you're in your parents' basement. So, and I was only in their basement for a couple of months, but then I was in Raleigh again until I was 27. And then I moved to Chicago to go to school. But I guess, I mean, like, it's, I understand what you're saying. Like, when you're from a big family, you have to differentiate yourself from the rest. But I think when you're at the top of that, like I'm the second oldest, then you're one of the original ones. So you don't have to work as hard as those kids at the bottom. Yeah.
Well, your last book, Theft by Finding, this is your diaries and a pretty unvarnished picture of yourself. Apparently you're not very concerned with your self-image, are you?
No. Well, I feel like the worse you admit to being, I think more people can relate to you, actually.
Have you always been like that? I mean, was there a part of you ever that was self-conscious and kind
of... Oh, sure. When I was growing up, I mean, and maybe that has something to do with it. You know, when I'm 61. So I grew up in an era when being gay was the worst thing that could possibly happen to a person. And even if you don't have the word for being gay when you're like 7, you know that you're different from other boys. And you know that there's something wrong with you and bad, and you have to never let anybody see that person. And so you kind of grow up, in a way you're almost disfigured because you're not being honest with about who you are, you know? And that's why it's so heartening to me to see, you know, I'll be signing books today and, you know, a woman will come up and say, this is my son, Chad, and he's gay and he's 12. And Chad's like, I kissed a guy once, Mom. You know, the mother's so eager to be accepting, you know, to me.
You have a really, I'm going to say, athletic or robust connection to your readers. You know, I've seen you at readings, people snaking around for hours, and you sign them and you talk with all of them. And in the book Calypso, there's a story about one of your readers who actually cut a tumor out of your side. Is that the strangest encounter you've ever had with a reader?
Maybe. I mean, I announced on stage. I mean, sometimes if you have a problem, well, you can talk about it on stage, and then your help. You know, there have been times when I said, you know, I think I have, I think I need a root canal. Can somebody write me a prescription for antibiotics? And somebody will do it. Or you say, there's something wrong with my computer. Or does anyone have a MacBook Air? Can you come up to the front of the line? And so it works for medical problems, too. And so this was, you know, a woman cut a tumor out of me just because I talked about it on stage. But in a way, you'd be like, if I were at dinner and I met someone and they were a doctor, I would not ask them for free advice because I know how doctors feel about that. But if I just talk about a medical problem on stage and then a doctor offers, that's different.
So maybe you could explain the circumstances of why you wanted to have a tumor cut out of you.
Well, it was just a little fatty tumor. It was a nothing, really. It was a lipoma. A lot of people have them. And I went to a surgeon for him to cut it out because I wanted to feed it to a snapping turtle. And he said he wouldn't give it to me. So that didn't seem fair to me. So I mentioned it on stage, and this woman said, you know, I'll give it to you. I'll cut it out of you. And she was a doctor. She wasn't a surgeon, but she was a doctor, and she did a great job. And then she shipped it on ice in North Carolina, and I fed it to a turtle.
That may be the first time I've ever heard a story anything remotely like that.
Well, I didn't do it to write about it. It just was one of those things that I don't know, just occurred to me. You know, just like if you had an arm amputated, why waste it?
Do you ever
like
sense...
why wouldn't they take it to the zoo? And that if they have hyenas at the zoo or something, why wouldn't they throw your arm to a hyena? Would you care?
No.
Yeah,
I mean, if they lost the arm already,
it'd be funny if the hyenas ate it and they were like, "Wait, we just discovered a way to sew back your arm, so it would have." Oh, but darn, those hyenas ate it.
David Sedaris, author of several best-selling books, most recently Calypso. I'm Virginia Prescott. Up next, how do people close to him feel about being his subjects? That's when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Public radio listeners first met David Sedaris as a young man working as a department store elf. Now he's a remarkably successful author, writing for The New Yorker, among other publications, and observing the indignities and upsides of aging. There are a few real joys to middle age, he writes in one of his essays from his new book, Calypso. The only perk I can see is that, with luck, you'll acquire a guest room. That's the kind of spin that we've come to know him for. In another essay, his longtime partner Hugh observes that he always writes about the negative instead of the positive. I asked David Sedaris about that when we spoke during his last trip through Georgia.
I don't know. The negative just makes for a better story, I think. Hugh, if Hugh and I are having, and I say, do you remember the time that you emptied that ashtray onto my lap? Why do you have to remember that? We were riding in a car in Normandy, and I put my cigarette out, and the ashtray was on the dashboard, and an ash flew into his eye, and he picked the whole ashtray out of the dashboard and dumped it in my lap. And I was we were getting ready to board a ferry for England, and I had white pants on, and then he emptied the whole ashtray into my, I'm going to forget that. I am not going to forget that.
So remembering the ashtray in the pants is more interesting than the drive to Normandy or drive to the ferry when everything was perfect and the clouds were puffy and lovely in the sky.
That he ruined all that when he emptied the ashtray into my lap. I mean, I would have just written about that, but then he emptied the ashtray into my lap and he ruined it. So it became a story about that. It became the day that he...
Dumped the ashtray into
my lap.
Does he mind being the subject of your stories?
No. He usually waits, and he wants to read the book when it's in galleys. But he knows that I'm not going to write anything about him. Like, I've never written what he looks like naked. I've never written sexually anything about him. It's all cosmetic, really. I mean, when I write about Hugh, I'm just kind of writing about making a life with somebody. And so I think anyone in the audience can relate to it. You don't have to be gay. You know, if you're trying to make a life with someone and sustain that relationship, then you can relate to it.
You also grew up at a time when people didn't talk to their parents about what they observed for their problems. Like in the book, you write about your mom and her alcoholism, and no one in your family called her on it or confronted her about her alcoholism. She eventually died of cancer. But you don't drink, right?
No.
No. Did you see yourself in her or her in you?
Sure. I mean, my mother and I were different kinds of drinkers. I mean, I would drink and then I would write. I mean, I had it in my mind that I could only write when I was drinking, which I don't know how. I guess because I started at around the same time, drinking and writing. And my mother didn't have any kind of an outlet for it. I don't know. It was just really hard. Her drinking seemed an expression of sorrow to me. And that makes me sad thinking about it. You know, when I wrote the essay, I wasn't making any big point. I guess I was just saying that a lot of really good people are alcoholics and they just don't have what it takes. For some reason, they don't have what it takes to quit. I mean, my mother would quit drinking for 4 days and, you know, call me up and say, tell me about it. And then I would call her the next night and, you know, I could tell right away that she was drinking again. She just didn't have the strength to quit. You know, I'm so used to, I'm 61. My mother died when she was 62. And I have moved so many times in my life. And I would move again tomorrow. And 10 years from now, hopefully I would feel free to move again. And, you know, I've learned, or I have a history of changing things for myself, you know, and my mother didn't. And so I think it was unfathomable for her that she could leave my father, that she could quit drinking, that she could start over again. I think 62 felt very, very old to her. And also because she didn't move around much, and she was a very heavy smoker, that, you know, I remember my mom came to visit me in Chicago once and we were taking the L and I went up the wrong staircase. And it was a lot of stairs for my mother and she just barely made it to the top. And then to say, oh, we have to go down and we have to cross the street and we have to go upstairs. I felt so bad about it. And I think 62 was old to her in a way that it's not to a healthier person or a sober person.
Yeah, and you almost at that age, are there things that you think of that you can't shake about, you know, dying at her age? Or
I always thought 62? I was going to die when I'm 62. And so I redid my will. And all I'm going to say is a lot of people are going to be really, really happy when I die. It was a lot of fun. It was fun to pick people who would say, who's he? Or people who just wouldn't, they would say, why did he do that? They're going to be really surprised when I die, a lot of people. It's going to be a beautiful day for a lot of people.
David Sedaris, author of books including Theft by Finding and most recently, Calypso. I'm Virginia Prescott. When we come back, do David Sedaris fans really know him? David Sedaris is author of 10 best-selling books, including Me Talk Pretty One Day, Holidays on Ice, and most recently, Calypso. His fans, or more accurately, devotees, are legion. All of them well acquainted with his family, his partner Hugh, and his wry, sidelong observations of the world. I spoke with David Sedaris on his last visit to Georgia. Given the intimate nature of his work and his reputation for staying sometimes hours at book signings to engage with fans, I asked David Sedaris if readers assume that they truly know him.
Yeah, but that's okay with me, you know. That's why when I meet people, like at a book signing, and it's true, it's just sort of lopsided that they know a lot about me and I don't know anything about them. So I was with an author not long ago. We were being interviewed together. And she said, when people come up to get a book signed, she said, if I don't say anything, I learn how they got there. Because they'll say, oh, I read something of yours in a magazine and then I bought your first book. I would never do that. I would never do that. The fact that they're there is enough for me. And I feel like I need to learn something about them, because to try to even that unbalance a bit. So when somebody comes to get a book signed from me, I just start asking them questions immediately. Someone tried to hashtag me to me
really?
A little while ago, because she came to get a book signed. And let's say her name was Meredith. I said, Meredith, have you ever had sex for money? But I just thought that was a funny question to ask somebody at a book signing. I just think that that's funny, you know? So, and I do enjoy, like, I love signing books. And I love, because it's, I'm talking to people and meeting them in a way that most people will never get a chance to. You can't go to a hotel and go up and ask the desk clerk anything you want. You can't, you know, a driver, you know, I never learned to drive a car. So often when I go places, there'll be a driver to take me. You're locked up in a space with somebody. So there's a lot of things you can't. I mean, it'd just be weird because you're in an enclosed area together. But if people came specifically to see you and to stand in line to talk to you for 2 minutes, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful little relationship, especially when they know enough about you. So it just really is all about them. I met a guy and I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm kind of trying to figure that out. I said, you should be an outlaw. You look just like one. And he said, I just got out of prison for 2 years for reckless endangerment and selling drugs. Everybody's interesting. A lot of people just don't know it. But I feel like sometimes somebody will come up to get a book signed and I don't like the person, usually because they're being too controlling. Right. And they want you to do this and do a certain way and draw a picture of this. But I don't want them to go away until I like them.
So you make it your work to like them.
Yeah. I think, OK, I don't like this person right now. But I don't want to leave it on this. I don't want to leave on this note.
So what would you say to them?
Gosh, it would really kind of depend on the person. But. Hopefully I could find some way to get them off that track and ask them a question that would disarm them. And then we could just completely get on another. Like, I need to let them know. This woman came up and she was, I don't know, she got on her knees, right? And I eat dinner while I sign books. So she got on her knees in front of the table and I think she'd been drinking. And I wrote in her book, "You Breathed on My Chicken." I don't want that on my book. I said, well, that's what you got. I said, because you breathed on my chicken. I need to write, "You're a breath of fresh air." And I said, you're not. You're not a breath of fresh air. You're just kind of annoying and you breathed on my chicken. But then I tried to put us on a different track because I didn't want to end it that way. Because I want to like the people who like me. I mean, I realized that a long time ago. It's a good policy to like people who like you.
I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more of my conversation with David Sedaris when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. David Sedaris' most recent book, Calypso, has all the biting wit and affectionate stories of his wacky family as his previous books. The essays recount family vacations at the home he and his longtime partner, Hugh, bought on the North Carolina shore. There, amid McMansions named Crab-a-Dab-a-Doo, Clam-a-Lot, Dolphin Song, and the like, they named their beach house C-Section. There is, of course, humor, but also a profound sadness in this book. In an essay called Now We Are Five, he writes about the suicide of his sister, Tiffany, who became estranged from the family. Here's David Sedaris talking about going through her belongings during an interview with Weekend Edition on NPR.
I was surprised when I heard. But then she left behind some notebooks. And when I look through the notebooks, I think, well, gosh, if that was my mind, if that's the way that I thought, I can understand wanting to put yourself out of that misery, right? Her thoughts were so disjointed, and even the note that we eventually found, the suicide note that she left, it was just so convoluted and so, it didn't make any sense when you thought, well, gosh, why would a person commit suicide over that?
Now back to my conversation with David Sedaris, recorded when his book Calypso first came out. Sedaris and his partner now live in England, and I asked him what it's like to come back to the new South.
Well, I mean, when I was growing up in North Carolina, the TV and radio broadcasters still had regional accents. And you don't find that so much anymore, and that's a sad thing. You know, like, I was listening to something a while ago, and I thought, well, that's completely fake, quote-unquote, Southern accent. Nobody has that accent. And then I heard an interview with Eudora Welty, and it's like, that's her accent. That was like, I don't know that that's still like a Jackson, Mississippi accent, but I think, I don't doubt that hers was a, I don't know if people still speak that way who are from Jackson, Mississippi, but I don't doubt that that was the way people spoke when she was still alive, in Jackson, Mississippi. It's like when you listen to old radio broadcasts, because I think you hear it and you notice it more, because I think when you look at a newsreel or film, you're caught up in somebody's looks and you're not listening to them so much. But when you listen to the way people in Maine used to speak, or the way that people on the south side of Chicago, or, gosh, you know, I mean, that was always interesting to me, to leave the South and then go to Chicago, where, you know, my sister was at Second City, and I would go and see shows, and people would say, oh, I can do a Southern accent, and you would just cringe for them, because you thought, there are, I don't know, there are probably 180 Southern accents just in North Carolina. Can you be a little bit more specific? Or you would watch a movie like Fried Green Tomatoes. Was that a movie? Am I thinking of the right thing? Where everybody has a different accent, but they're all supposed to be from that town. I mean, it wasn't like they'd, you know, moved here and here, wound up there. And also the way I think that they would give someone a Southern, if you want somebody to be stupid, you give them a Southern accent.
Right.
And people still do that to this day, which I just find curious. But especially, I think, coming from England, it's nice to come back here, because in England, most countries, people in the South are warmer than people in North. England, it's the opposite. And people in the South are cold. And I will pass somebody out in the village, you know, and I'm always the first one to say hello. 9 times out of 10, I say hello. They say nothing back. Someone will be standing in front of their house. I say hello. They will just turn their back on me.
Wow.
And that is so very different than where we are on the coast of North Carolina. It's exhausting. I mean, people will call hello to you from inside their house. inside their house, and you're walking by on foot. And it's...
How did they get anything done?
I know it.
Well, David Sedaris, what a pleasure to speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
David Sedaris, author most recently of Calypso. We spoke when the book first came out in June, and I had just arrived at GPP and was not yet on the air. A few days later, I received a postcard thanking me and wishing me luck and saying, we were both fresh, me on the first day of my book tour and you your first week. I found you to be an excellent host, so easy to talk to. Best of luck on the new job. Sincerely, David Sedaris. So gracious, so personable, and so encouraging. For me, it's a good story, with nothing negative to say at all.